Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, we react to the Oscars. We announce our wager winner. Shazam! Fury of the Gods hits theaters, and we sit down with director David Sandberg. Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 253 of Real Blend, a podcast that's holding its after party at CGI Fridays, baby.
Damn,
see
right.
You there. We'll see you there.
Damn
on this
right.
Week's show. We're reacting to the Oscars. We're going to announce our wager winner. Shazam! Fury of the Gods is hitting theaters. And because of that, director David Sandberg sat down with the crew to discuss his Shazam sequel. And by the crew, I mean myself, Sean O'Connell, the managing editor of Cinema Blend, even though I wasn't part of that interview. But it was handled beautifully by Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hello, Jakey.
I love that you just said that, like, by the crew that he sat down with, I mean me, who was not there.
Who was not there. But Kevin McCarthy was there from Fox 5 of Washington, D.C. as well. Hey, Kev, how are you?
I was there. Not the other Kevin McCarthy, but I was there. Yes, I was there for that.
Are you getting hammered by political
all the
political
time.
Tweets?
Yeah. It's okay, though. I mean, I was every time I slate myself on an interview now, I have a weird feeling in my stomach that their person's going to hear my name and just automatically have a thought about that. So I always clarify right off the bat, I'm not that guy. Just a heads up.
So awkward. Hello, if you're watching us on YouTube, thank you very much for tuning into the visual element of the show. We drop every Friday. Hit subscribe, turn on your notifications, give us a like, and actually weigh in the comments down below. That is very helpful to the channel. We are learning from the YouTube algorithm. So hit like, and like I said, chime in down below. At YouTube.com/RealBlendPodcast. Well, yes, please.
I don't know. I don't read the comments. Are the people nice?
For the most part.
Usually yeah. Pretty nice.
95% of the time. Yeah, I think so.
The other 5%, Kevin's mom.
Yes. Have you signed up for Real Blend Premium? Because you can get an ad-free version of the show. You get a newsletter, not this week, from me. And you get an additional segment of the show that drops on Mondays. Always a good time.
I've a crazier segment.
Generally, a little more loose, a little more free flowing. A couple of games, usually some games played on that one. Some junket stories. We like to share some junket stories in that one. Somebody was just on the Facebook page talking about the fact that they signed up for premium because they were going on a really long road trip. And it made me want to sort of go back and re-listen to a bunch of the premiums to see like how they hold up or how they. Like, I don't know how cringy they are.
Something tells me the premiums might have a, not to like knock our main show, but the premiums might have more of a re-listen value just because of how crazy and unpredictable they are. They're like less structured and they're just a little bit more. I mean, we literally start the episode and usually in the middle of a conversation.
Right. And they're not driven by news, which could be outdated or something like that. So it's Gabe Kovach weighing in as well, too. Hello, Gabe, in the producer's chair. Somebody recommended a fourth square up at all time.
I think there should be
in the thing. Gabe, how do you feel about this?
Well, then it would reveal my secret, which is I'm always frantically trying to get you guys to move on.
That's true.
Visually.
That's a good point. Visually.
It would just be a square of a guy going.
Yeah.
Gabe has no time for nonsense.
Yeah. It would just be my exhausted face.
Gabe is Tarantino's favorite Real Blend member.
That's true. The Real Talk member.
Yeah.
By the way, only because he thinks I'm his publisher. So, or editor,
Quentin has a new movie called The Movie Critic. Apparently, we'll be talking about that a lot.
Is it the film critic or the movie critic?
The movie critic.
I think the movie critic.
I'm surprised he's not calling it the film critic.
Well, he's going to be talking about Jaws, not The Godfather.
Oh, but it takes place in the 70s, reportedly, with a female lead. So I'm curious, like what?
Well, speculation is that it's about Pauline Kael.
Oh, was she in the 70s?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And around that time in 1979, she left The New Yorker to go work for Warren Beatty for a little while.
Oh, wow.
And there's, again,
speculation. He does talk about her a lot.
Nobody knows this. This might be that story. But I mean, that's pure speculation just from people who think that they're in the know. So
that makes sense because he mentions her a lot in interviews. And I believe... Yeah. Yeah, I guess he just do a whole book on 70s films.
Yes. Yeah. Cinema speculation.
Yeah. So
and imagine if he got Uma.
See, Uma would be good. I saw someone else suggest Jennifer Jason Leigh. That's also a pretty good fit.
But Uma, I mean, and maybe I'm putting too much significance in it being his last film, but like the lead should be, I think, one of his Mount Rushmores. I was really hoping that the lead would be like Uma or a Sam Jackson, or even honestly, I wouldn't mind Brad. You know, I love Jennifer Jason Leigh, but yeah, it just feels like it could be a great sort of like
it's
him
be,
back
with
Uma
be Mike Myers.
Yeah, or Fassbender or something like that. All right, listen, it's Shazam Fury of the Gods week. And before we get to David Sandberg, who is a terrific director, I want to plug both of our segments with Radio Silence, the guys who directed Scream 6 on Wednesday of this week. If you guys missed the episode, we did a spoiler filled deep dive into Scream 6 with those guys. Lots of interesting topics that they brought
it
up.
It also turned into me just pitching ideas for Scream 7 and them going, sure, I guess.
Yeah, very much so. You really lobbied hard for Laurie Metcalf to show up in one of these films.
Hey, I'm telling you, man, Sheldon's mom never goes wrong.
I thought you'd go Roseanne. No, maybe that's before your time.
I forget that she's. Yeah.
Yeah. But those are two interesting interviews you should definitely listen to. Do the spoiler free one if you haven't seen the film yet. That was from last Friday. And then once you've seen Scream 6, go into the spoiler filled. This conversation,
is a very Laurie Metcalf heavy interview, which is the only interview that I think you can say that on Real Blend. Like, we went heavy on Laurie Metcalf,
like unusually heavy on Laurie Metcalf. The directors gave us a look at some point where they were just like, hey, if you guys interview her, please.
Yeah, that's what they said. If you interview her, ask her for us.
Yeah, tell her we said hello, please.
We got a message from someone today on Twitter or something saying Lori has this coming out or that coming out. Like, Jake, you should ask her. which is a sign that people are listening.
Ambassador spokesperson for Lori Metcalf.
Yeah. I love the thought of you hunting down an interview to ask.
Are to
you
ask about her, if she's returning for a role that she once played 25 years ago.
Yeah,
I don't imagine she'd be very hard to get. We should really effort her for the podcast. I think she'd be an interesting conversation. So without further ado, now with Shazam Fury of the Gods opening in theaters, we have David Sandberg returning to the Real Blend podcast.
Kevin McCarthy and Jake Hamilton from the Real Blend podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, by the way. It's an honor to have you, and you're a returning guest. Last time we had you was with Peter for the first Shazam film, yeah. And honored to have you back on the show. But we're going to just open up with this because obviously there's a lot of news in the DC world and kind of what's going on with all the films and all the connections to things. And we were just wondering where you're at with Shazam and kind of how that's going to factor into what's going on with Peter and James and kind of what they're dealing with now in terms of, you know, rebuilding the DC films and the universe. Like, where does Shazam going to fit into this?
Well, I don't know what their full plans are, but, you know, I've been told that there's nothing in Shazam that contradicts what they're doing with the universe. So he could continue to exist, you know, in his current form,
right?
So we'll see.
Did the announcement at all, like this, like James's announcement, which was amazing, did that at all give you a certain excitement about where what you could do with, like, how it would factor in
with Shazam? You mean, I mean, the movie was already done.
No, I'm talking about the future.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just a big fan of James Gunn, so I'm really excited to see what they do with the DC. I mean, I think the announcement was really cool. I mean, some characters I'm not even familiar with, but they look really cool. And then of course others really big ones, you know, like doing more with like Green Lantern and all of that. And of course Superman. So yeah, it's all very exciting.
Well, also I want to give sort of people a peek behind the scenes of what's going on right now. So obviously we're in a hotel doing this junket, but Peter Safran is here walking around the hallways talking to people. Like, he's not really doing the junket. He's not doing like traditional interviews, but he's just walking around. And that feels like such a symbol of support and a vote of confidence for you guys and for the movie and for this character and for this franchise. Yeah, I'm just sort of curious what that means to you to just have him here just saying, hey, I'm just here to support you guys.
I mean, it's his movie too. He's the producer on it. So, you know, he's pretty invested, I think.
We don't normally see that. Like, we don't normally see that producer just walking around and hanging out.
No, I mean, Peter is great. I mean, he was there on set almost every day, and like, that's the way he is. I mean, this is my third movie with Peter now, so he's awesome.
Yeah. You know, we were talking earlier about visual effects, and one of the things we talked about in the first movie was how you lit up the suit. And one of the things that was really cool about it was that the lighting of the suit actually ended up being lighting that was used in the film. It could light your characters' faces. And there's a brilliant shot towards the end of this film, which I won't dive into specifically, where he's walking in a dark area and it just looks incredible. Were there any upgrades in terms of the lighting, how the suit operated? For our audience, we're a filmmaker podcast, so we like to dive into like the details about how cinematography and score and everything like that, but how does it affect the cinematography process?
Well, in the first movie, I wanted to do it like all practical, like build it into the suit and just keep it that way. And it gave us a lot of problems. Well, I mean, just malfunction, like technical issues, because there's a lot of wires going through the whole suit and you have to change batteries in the back and everything.
This was your shark in Jaws. Like, this was your, like, Spielberg getting over the shark problem.
There were a lot of shots where it's like, oh, cut, you know, the bolt is not working. And then it's turned into visual effects shots a lot in the end anyway, because I wanted to have a little bit of a pattern and something moving in there so it wasn't just a flat color. So for this one, it was like, well, let's not try to do it all practical. We can do a hybrid approach, you know. So, I also split it up so that in daytime, when that light isn't going to do much anyway, it doesn't light up. So that's just sort of what the suit looks like. And then in the nighttime, we put like a little light on top of the suit instead, so you get the interactive lightning on the faces and everything, but it's a much less complicated when it's on the outside and you can just take it on or off.
Oh, I see. And could you give an example of a shot where like it does shift maybe from like CG to dealing with the practical aspects of it? Like I just find it fascinating because it looks
all the shots when they light up, it's CG because they had to take paint out the light and you know, so the light that we had on there was just to throw light onto their faces and the environment.
And you can still use that lighting.
It's just you just have to then replace the bolt with a CG bolt that looks the way it's supposed to look.
Cool. I love that kind of stuff.
I want to talk about the post-credit scene for the first film.
Yep.
In which Mark Strong is talking with the Caterpillar, who for Shazam fans know that like that's going to end up being a major character. Was that ever in consideration for being the plot of the sequel? Or it was?
Yeah. No, when we started talking about this, we actually had the idea that it was Mr. Mind who let the sisters into our world, that it was part of his bigger scheme or plot. But it was just too much story to tell. Because, I mean, even without him in it, it's still a 2-hour and 10-minute movie. So it just didn't fit. You know, we just had to have the sisters come on their own.
Yeah.
Story for another day?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah,
I'd love to see more.
That would be awesome. You know, there's a great moment early on. I like that they keep newspaper clippings of kind of what happens and how they're in the news.
They're big fans of themselves.
Right. I was curious. Do you remember the first time you saw something about you in a newspaper? Like, do you remember clipping anything or looking at anything? Like maybe like one of your reviews or a film that came out. Like, what do you have a memory of a newspaper clipping that meant a lot to you?
Well, I got my sort of first viral hit in Sweden in my 20s, where I did a pretty crude animated short that had a lot of swears and nudity and things like that in it. And I remember opening up the local newspaper one day, and it was like a screenshot from my YouTube movie, and it was this big article. This was this politician who was very upset with the movie because he mistakenly thought that it had been funded with taxpayer money. It was like, tax money shouldn't go to this filth and stuff like that. But that was such a shock to open, like, because they hadn't reached out to me. So I just opened a newspaper, and there's like that's my movie. This is an article about me.
Did you clip it out?
Of course.
where is that? Where's that now?
It's at home in Sweden somewhere.
Did
in
you
storage.
Frame it?
No, but I kept it.
That's so cool. That must have been like I don't know. I just thought about that, how cool that would be. Because again, you're in a business where things are going to be written about you in newspapers and all. I mean, now in the digital age, it's not really like a thing that happens as much anymore with clipping it. But
yeah, no, but there's a lot of like online articles, which is sometimes a hassle. Because sometimes you just want to, you know, you're on a subreddit or something, and you just want to answer someone's question, but then someone picks it up and it's an article. Oh, the Shazam director says this. It's like, oh no, don't make a big deal out of it. I just wanted to talk to
I just tweeted this.
You know,
Shazam fans know that, you know, if you follow the comics, at some point Black Adam should be involved in the story in some form or fashion. There were rumors of an attempt to potentially try to get The Rock involved in some form or fashion. I'm just sort of curious, like, how far that actually got beyond just, oh, it would be cool.
No, I mean, he was supposed to be in the first movie originally, until they split it up into two movies. He was never a part of this movie. We knew that they were going to do Black Adam as a separate thing. And so, no, that was never a part of this one.
Were you ever in conversation with him about, like, how are we going to do this down the road? Or was that a conversation for another day?
Yeah, I've never met him, so no, yeah. No.
I want to talk about Skittles, because I'm a big fan of Skittles, and I love that that was like a through line in the film. And we were talking about this yesterday, and Jake actually said this about it, like it's a really brilliant way to do product placement. I mean, we don't know if it's actually product placement or not, but if it was, it was smart.
No, I mean, it's something that was written in the script as Skittles, and then, you know, you reach out to Mars Company or whoever and like, hey, can we use this? And I think it's, I'm sure some people will go like, oh, it's product placement. But to me, I like that more than when you make up these weird.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. They're
eating, that's what we're saying.
They're eating Skittles.
It's a plot point.
Yeah.
And it just so happens to be
brilliant.
Like a product that all of us are familiar with.
Yeah.
But it progresses the plot forward in a way, which I was just like, that's actually brilliant.
Save the world.
Well, it's just because I think we've just seen so many examples of really poor product.
Right.
Like, man, I'm so tired from saving the day. Thank God I have these Skittles. Like, you know, we've seen the opposite of that. So I just think you did a really brilliant way of like making it a part of the actual plot of the movie.
Also, he plays around with the colors, which is really funny too, because like everybody's obsessed with strawberry. Everybody always is. I mean, I am as well. And the yellow one always.
There was a big debate on that because Henry, the writer, he thought it was cherry. The red ones. So that's what it was in the script. And people are like, wait, no, that's actually wrong. And we had to change it. And,
yeah. I love that.
Because green used to be lime, but it's apple.
Green apple. They went back to lime, I think.
I don't know.
Yeah. The yellow ones get the short stick, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love from the first film the brief moment where Superman shows up to lunch.
Yeah. Mm.
And just the way you frame it, the way it looked, just like the cut to black after that, it's such a great moment. I'm just sort of curious, I'd heard that like Cavill, it was actually supposed to be him, but like he couldn't because of the scheduling. How different would that scene, how would you have shot it? Would it have gone longer? What are the differences if he had been involved?
It would have been longer. He would have had a little scene there with the kids. It wasn't like anything amazing. I think the way it worked out is actually the funnier option because it gets laugh because it's so sudden. But I mean, it would have been cool to have him in there, but I think it works really well the way it turned out.
Yeah. You know, obviously you come from, you've been making films for years, and as you do these bigger budgets, you still continue to keep, in my opinion, the start of how you start off as a filmmaker. They're like, it's still weaved in, and the kind of the different things that you like, the horror elements are really there. How much like percentage of that goes into your mind when you're making a film on this scale and the idea that you still want to weave in those aspects of horror? And obviously there's story points in this that lend to that because you have a lot of creatures and monsters that can play around with that horror aspect of it. But is that something that's just important to you to always keep within your films, no matter what genre you're working in? And like, how much does that mean to you that you can still kind of weave those things in, even in a world like this?
I think you need it because it creates a real sense of danger or a real threat. Makes you more invested in it. Mm. I just love doing it as well. Love my monsters and things like that, designing them and getting to have them, you know, ruin Philadelphia.
What's it like to see them come to life, though, when you design it and then you finally see the full CG version of that character? Like, is there how does that make you feel when you actually see it fully realized?
It's really cool. I mean, it takes a really long time. So, I mean, you first see the movie, and even when you show it to test audience and stuff, that stuff isn't done. Mm. So it takes a really long time before you finally get to see it the way it's supposed to be. Mm. And that's it's very exciting when you work for like, we've been in post-production for like a year and finally I get to see what it actually looks like. Because it doesn't look great when it's like previs and things like
but
that.
But it looks awesome in the movie.
You and I spoke for television just about an hour ago, and you told me something that I'd love to follow up on, because I asked you about how you have to account for the fact that other superheroes do exist in this world, but they're not showing up to help save the day. And you told me a story that you came up with an idea to potentially have Batman and Superman in this story, but Warner Brothers said no.
Well, yeah, sort of. Because I was to think, well, you know, we could have like a scene of just outside the dome, you know, where you see like, oh, Superman, maybe he's trying to get in there. Or like, even if you see it on a news report or something from far away. But if... It wasn't totally serious because it also opens up a whole can of worms.
For
like,
sure.
Like, where are they? Where did they go? You right.
know? They just walked away?
No, they're like, yeah, we can't do this. Let's go back to the Batcave or something.
Was the pitch to actually try to get Ben and Henry, or would you have no. shot it in the way that you we sometimes see, like how we saw Superman?
Well, I mean, it didn't, like I said.
It didn't get that far? So,
no, it wasn't totally serious. And I think if anything, it probably would have been just like on a news report and you just see a tiny figure.
Oh, interesting. You know? Okay, very cool.
You know, I told you about this line earlier, but that I love in the film, about the most powerful thing you have is you, essentially. I'm paraphrasing it, but the idea of like thematically knowing that yourself is the most powerful thing and the most important thing.
Right.
And this concept of like all the thematics you deal with foster care and everything, there's so many serious aspects to it. The bullying thing to me really hit me because that was me in high school. I mean, I remember being beat up like that. I remember trying to be nervous to talk to girls and things like that. So I was just curious, does that come from a place of, from for you personally? Were you bullied in school? Is that something that you had dealt with?
Yeah, what nerd wasn't?
No, but there's extremities to it. And like, I'm 38 and I'm still in therapy talking about it today. And I just wondered, like, you know, when you put that in a film, it resonates with me and people who probably have been through similar things. And not everybody got beat up in school, but I mean, yeah. I know some people did.
It makes it real because yeah. It is unfortunately a reality. And it was interesting as well because, you know, having test screenings for this movie, you know, there were people who were like, hey, the bullies didn't get their comeuppance, you know, like they got away with it in this one because we see them being mean to Freddy and then we don't see them again.
That happened to me. Bullies got away with it all the time.
I know. It's real, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's cathartic to watch it. It really is.
I want to talk about Rachel Zegler, who I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
You guys cast her in this before West Side Story came out.
Yes.
So people weren't even truly aware of everything that she had the capabilities of doing. I'm just sort of curious.
Yeah, I was.
What it was about her before seeing her performance at West Side Story, and then what was it like when you finally got to see her performance at West Side Story?
Well, to me, yeah, she was just one of many girls who auditioned, but she just had such presence and such, she's so charming and so just watchable. I mean, I think she is really a movie star. So we did, you know, chemistry reads with like her and Jack, but over Zoom because of COVID and everything. And the amazing thing was that it still worked. Like you could still feel sort of the chemistry and everything. So she's amazing. And then, you know, I've found out afterwards just how amazing she is. Like I didn't know about her whole singing and, you know, all the stuff she does on YouTube and things like that, and how talented she is. That's something I've discovered afterwards. And it's kind of funny how she sings in every other movie. She doesn't sing in this one because I didn't even know.
Try to like rethink putting in a musical
sequence. Yeah, would you have written one in?
Like,
yeah.
No, I don't think it would have fit, but you know, maybe you could have done something during the credits or something.
I just spoke to her and she had nothing but amazing things to say about you, and I told her I would tell you that. So she loves you.
Then the check cleared.
I was a check. $20, she said.
Yeah.
You know, there's one thing about this film like that I love in terms of obviously the way you deal with comedy and you go back and forth with actual reality of thematics as I was talking about. But I was wondering, like, as a filmmaker at the end of making a film, do you find a catharsis that you find in your own life after it's over? Like, do you learn things about yourself through the process? And yeah. I mean, obviously as a filmmaker, you grow as you make more and more movies, but do you find yourself understanding more about yourself through the movies that you make?
Definitely. It's making movies is very challenging, but I never regret it. And it's always worth it afterwards. Cause yeah, you do learn a lot of things and then you grow, and like that's why I'm always so eager to just make another movie because I learned so much that I now want to apply and get to use in another one. So it's I just want to make as many movies as I can.
What's the most important thing you learned on this one that you'll take to the next one?
The most important thing, it's just learning to work at such a scale, for one thing, but it's also just learning more and more about working with actors and sort of what's needed and sometimes how little is needed as well, with certain things, that you don't have to overthink certain things. And it's hard to be specific, but
thank you, man, for joining our show. We really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to have you on, and congratulations on the film. Everybody can see it on March 17th in theaters. So
I appreciate you, man. Seriously, thanks, man. Thank you so much.
David.
Naturally, we want to thank our very good friends at Warner Brothers Pictures and DC Films for hooking us up with some additional time with David Sandberg. Shazam Fury of the Gods is in theaters as we speak, so make sure you guys go see it and be careful online if you want to go into it unscathed, because there are some very important details from the story that are now part of the marketing materials. And so that's the decision that that DC decided to go down. I still think it's a lot of fun. We're going to review it. We'll do a full review on Shazam Fury of the Gods later on in the show. But before that, we have to get to, I know it's a week later and everyone has talked about the show to death. But, you know, we started off as an awards podcast, and we're going to discuss the Oscar telecast that most recently happened, hosted by Jimmy Kimmel. A couple of the awards that were, I think, largely predictable: Everything Everywhere All at Once taking home Best Picture, the Daniels getting director. One of the biggest surprises, I think, was Jamie Lee Curtis taking Supporting Actress. Even she seemed extremely surprised. Everything Everywhere All at Once doing really well in all of the acting categories, and then Brendan Fraser taking Best Actor. But in general, Kev, being someone who's kind of on the same page with me lately, and I think Jake, we've been saying that the Oscars telecast has had problems, you know, and has needed to sort of overcome some of these obstacles to keep people engaged. What was your reaction to the ceremony in general? How do you think that it played?
First of all, I loved it. I thought it was one of the best Oscars I've seen in a long time. There are a lot of details of it that I really thought were really special. Like the idea that it really celebrated movies and reminded me why I love watching movies and why I love going to watch the Oscars, right? I mean, I've never been to the Oscars, but they're my Super Bowl. They just really are. And leading up to it, I kept thinking this is too late for this to be happening in March, because these movies have been out for a while. But then the night of, I was just like so amped and so excited. A few things that I wanted to point out were the detail to filmmaking. One of my favorite moments of the night was the editing award. And if you looked behind the presenters during the editing award, you saw a woman at an edit machine with film, mm-hmm. like actually splicing film. And I also thought the show really highlighted the importance of theatrical. And Kimmel obviously joking about the two people who were most responsible not being there, James Cameron and Tom Cruise. Yeah. But, you know, it was a show that made me cry. I don't remember the last time I cried at the Oscars. I mean, like Kiwi Kwan's speech when he said, "Mom, I just won an Oscar," right into the camera. That felt so immersive.
Use that clip so much for the promo next year.
But it was so beautiful. And like and then Michelle Yeoh's speech, and then just every single moment, every speech from awards that might not have been important to general audiences, even this, like the speeches from the sound and the documentary features and everything. It was just
the
really,
happy birthday moment in the Best Live Action Short. Like that's the most I've cared about Best Live Action Short.
Yeah, and it was really just kind of a beautiful ceremony from start to finish. And I thought Kimmel did a really good job. Like he had a really, you know, I'm glad how he handled the Will Smith thing. I thought he made some funny jokes, but he didn't spend too much time on it. Chris Rock already did that on his Netflix special. So Kimmel kind of came at it from a very interesting perspective. Like I think he made a joke about Hitch, and he was like, "The show's going to go off without a hitch and without Hitch," which I thought was, you know, that was funny. I mean, and
CGI Friday's joke.
CGI Friday's joke. So for people who didn't maybe watch the Oscars that didn't know the joke that Sean was making, basically after the visual effects award, Kimmel came back on camera and he said, you know, they're all going to meet at CGI Fridays after the visual effects award. And that was my favorite one liner after an award since Jon Stewart came back after Hustle and Flow 3-6 Mafia won. And at that point in time, Martin Scorsese had never won an Oscar. So he was like, you know, 3-6 Mafia won Oscar, Martin Scorsese zero. It was just such a funny line. I remember running into him on the street one time and like telling him that, and he was like dying laughing. Cause like those are like jokes they probably forget they even said, or like the CGI Fridays one is probably something Kimmel was just like a throwaway joke, but it was so funny to me. That being said, overall, I thought it was a great show, great speeches. It felt important. But also, we are in a good time right now in terms of movies. And, you know, with last year with Avatar and Top Gun making the billions of dollars that they did combined, But then now this year, to see Creed open to $100 million, to see the box office really kind of thriving, the summer's going to be huge with Mission Impossible. I just feel like we are lucky to be back in a period where movies feel important again. They feel, I mean, the ratings for the show, I want to say we're up a good amount of percentage. I think they did like, was it 18 million? I don't know the exact number.
Almost Jake, 19.
Yeah. That's massive. I mean, considering how low these shows have been going and how everything's been going down. And I don't subscribe to the idea that the show did better because people were curious about how they were going to handle the slap in this. I think that people tuned in because the movies were strong. I mean, the movie that won Best Picture made over $100 million worldwide at the box office and then continued to crush it home on demand. These aren't movies that people didn't see. People saw Elvis. People saw Top Gun. People saw Avatar. I mean, these were all well attended films, and people really wanted to see Brendan Fraser on that stage. I mean, Whale didn't make a ton of money, but that story is insane. I will say, I thought Brendan Fraser's speech was better at the Critics' Choice Awards than it was at the Oscars.
It's but a few I also too feel many like, nautical metaphors in there. And I could have done without one or two.
A couple of whale jokes that, yeah. But in all honesty, though, I was very impressed with it. I thought it was just designed in a way that reminded me and hopefully reminded the 18 million plus people that or whoever watched it afterwards that movies are such a powerful part of our lives, and it's not a trivial thing. It's not something we take lightly. I get that you could be cynical and be jaded about where we are maybe in the industry, but I don't feel that way at all. That show felt magical to me. It felt magical. Like, I was very, very happy with it.
So here's the thing. I can't, because I'm trying to step back and put my finger on what separated this telecast from the other previous ones. And I don't know what it
direction.
Is,
but it was directed well. It was paced well. The awards were in the right place. Even the middle of the show, when it was the awards that we were waiting for the best actor and actress and everything, even those middle sections were done well. Because to Jake's point, like someone to get on stage and that we don't know giving a speech and then a birthday moment happens, it just felt so fluid. I felt like I was sitting there going, they must be behind the scenes seeing that this is like magic. It felt like it was like just perfectly floating along. I mean,
I guess, but that seems like luck. I mean, that a little bit of that seems like luck, because you don't know if the happy birthday moment is going to happen. So
yeah, but then you got Gaga stripped down doing that amazing performance.
That was amazing.
Black shirt, black pants, no makeup. Chuck Taylor's intimate, emotional Rihanna's song made me cry just hearing her sing it the way she did. It was just a really beautiful ceremony. And then Not to that whole dance number was insane. I hope people see RRR after that. I loved it.
Jake, what stood out to you?
Well, my biggest problem with the Oscars these past few years is that the ceremony and the structure of it and the production of it and the design of it and the direction of it and the bits that were scattered throughout seemed to be chasing an audience that was never going to watch the Oscars. The Oscars were built for people who had no interest in watching the Oscars. So those of us who did, who just wanted to see movies honored and celebrated for a night, were left to these bits that were strung throughout the ceremony. And oftentimes the acting categories were rushed through with images of people's performances rather than clips of their performances. The reason I love this show as much as I did is that it didn't seem to be chasing after a demographic that wasn't interested in watching. They weren't going after the young TikTok audience. They weren't trying to throw in bits for a younger audience to kind of keep things going. Like the whenever they showed the acting categories, they showed what the performances looked like. I mean, there were so many things. They didn't do a joke that they set up at the beginning of the show and it took the entire show to pay off to get to the end and realize that the joke wasn't that funny to begin with. It all felt very old school and traditional to me. It reminded me of the days when Billy Crystal used to come out, tell a few jokes, rat-a-tat-tat, and then, let's get on, let's move on. And then he would show back up, and then that was it.
You remember when Billy Crystal would insert himself into the movies? Like that was a recurring
Kimmel was in Top Gun, I was like, that was the first sign to me of like, maybe we're going old school Billy Crystal. And it the whole show felt very Billy Crystal era to me, which is perfect.
Kimmel is so great at what he does.
I'm a big Kimmel fan.
He's a really good host. And I, you know, again, I don't watch late night shows all the time, but I watch clips online. But the way he comes out on that stage, there's a humility to the way he does his things. I don't know. I find him. I listen to Howard Stern all the time, and Stern has him on a lot, and Stern talks about him a lot. Kimmel, I just think Kimmel's great at what he does. He's really good.
I did a montage on Stern clips where he, over the years, interviewed the Oscar hosts, specifically about hosting, like after the fact. And it reminded me how many hosts we've had that I just forgot. Seth MacFarlane hosted one year.
Oh, my God.
MacFarlane.
Neil Patrick Harris.
Do you remember MacFarlane's opener? Yes, I'm not going to get into it, but I cannot believe he got away with that. Like, that was, can you imagine doing that now? There's no way. No.
Neil Patrick Harris hosted one time.
Oh, my God. I just
completely forgot that Neil Patrick Harris had hosted. Jon Stewart, obviously, we talked about. Yeah, yeah.
Well, because that had to be at the time when, because remember, he was crushing it for a while at the Tonys.
Right.
Oh. And then that had to be sort of in the way. But dude, I always forget that Hugh Jackman do it.
Jackman was one of the best hosts ever.
I remember liking really Jackman because it was like the year that apparently like it was like during the strike where they had no money and the opening was all about how like things were made out of cardboard and he like wanted to do a big musical number but they didn't have money for it. Yeah. So it was him doing stuff with cardboard. Yeah. I remember liking him.
But what I'm most amazed at is that this show, and because Kevin mentioned it too, like he cried. The show this year made me care about these movies.
Yes.
Whereas when I'm at this point, because they happen too late, there's no question about the fact that they happen too late. They should not happen in March. We are to the point, we are already immersed into March movies. And when you tell me that we're going to talk about Everything Everywhere All at Once or Banshees of Inisherin, and it's like, I've moved past those movies. But this ceremony made me care about them again. Like seeing Ke Huy Quan get up and accept, seeing Michelle Yeoh get up and accept. Seeing Jamie Lee Curtis talk about her parents getting nominated.
Oh my God. Her mom nominated in the same category as her supporting actress for Psycho.
Was she nominated for Psycho?
Psycho, supporting actress, 1961.
Who beat Janet Leigh?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I remember interviewing Jamie Lee Curtis on the Universal lot for the 2018 Halloween. And I remember going on to the lot that day. And I remember, I think there was a Tony Curtis road. Mm-hmm. And then I think
we had to drive by the Psycho house to get there.
And I remember sitting there on that lot and her telling me stories about, I think she told me the great story about watching True Lies with her parents. And I don't know, I'll have to go back and find the clip, but like the history of her story is insane. I still think Angela Bassett still should have won in my personal opinion, but we can dive into that later.
Who beat Janet Leigh, Gabe?
Shirley Jones for Elmer Gantry.
Interesting. Do you have the five nominees for that year?
Yeah. So Mary Urey, I believe is that name. Sons and Lovers. Janet Leigh for Psycho.
Wow.
Another Shirley. Don't call me Shirley. Shirley Knight for The Dark at the Top of the Stairs, which is a great name. I kind of want to see the short film version of that.
What a great title.
And then Glynis Johns for The Sundowners, and then Shirley Jones winning for Elmer Gantry.
Interesting.
And what's funny is I haven't seen the film that won. I mean, out of all those five, I've only seen Psycho, but it is wild to think which one remained in our culture, in our mindsets since the win.
Jake, doesn't The Dark at the Top of the Stairs sound like a really great house kind of movie where you're following like a group of kids?
Sounds almost like The Changeling where the ball rolls down the stairs.
That's good.
All right. So in general, all of us thought it was a great telecast.
Yeah.
More of that, please.
Yes.
Although I can't quite put my finger on what more of that is. I guess it's love of cinema, which you shouldn't have to tell the Oscar producers that, hey, more love of movies, please. But I guess that's what we got away from because it returned in full force.
But also to answer your question, Sean, I think it was just the movie slate last year, to be honest with you. It was a phenomenal year. Like it was a great movie year. So like people were genuinely invested in that show because of the, I mean, people, everybody's, Elvis made a ton of money. People, I mean, think about all the younger generations who were tuning in to watch possibly Austin Butler win. And they had him front row right next to Angela Bassett. You know, they designed that seating perfectly. They knew exactly what they were doing.
Well, do they? I mean, the design of let's I mean, you can tell when the Oscars are pretty sure what's going to win by who they have presenting, and having Harrison Ford presenting Best Picture, they knew exactly. Honestly, even having Halle Berry present, because we knew that Will Smith wasn't going to present Best Actress. So having Halle Berry do it was like just do you think when Halle Berry walked out, Kate Blanchett went, shit, I definitely lost.
Also, one thing I'll note as well, I love the overhead shots of the chairs and the lights.
Oh, that was fantastic. Okay,
it was really cool.
The only thing I didn't love is there was a shot that they would take of the winners from the side that featured, like, in the distance, a photo of their character. And sometimes, like, they would choose weird photos. Like, there was a shot of Ke-Huy Quan, and the photo in the distance is his character dying with blood coming out of his face. And I was like, I just remember thinking, like, surely there had to be a better photo of him from that movie to use.
Do you ever watch my favorite thing to do now is watch the actor's face after the clip is shown, because sometimes they're so confused as to why that particular clip was used. Mm-hmm. And like, there were a couple, I'm trying to remember the specific ones. I mean, I knew which one they were going to use for Bassett. That seemed obvious because it's a phenomenal sequence. But there were a few that I thought, I think I remember.
But I like how they did this year. It was like one clip, but it was like also a montage of stuff. Like, it was almost like a highlight reel. Like, yeah, it was focused on one chunk of their performance. But there were clips of them from other moments in the movie. I thought it was very well done.
Nothing beats when the previous winners, like a slate of previous winners, came out and talked about them. They only did that the one year. And
I'd imagine it just took too much time. But like, I loved when they did that.
Yeah, that was great. What's up, Gabe?
Were you guys surprised by the movies that got no love at all? Like Elvis?
I was surprised Elvis got nothing. Honestly, Spielberg has directed a few movies that have gone over at the Oscars.
Banshees
got zero.
Banshees.
But you know what's funny is, though, like, even the movies that didn't win still felt like they were a great part of the show. The whole bit with Jenny coming out.
Yeah,
the Jenny thing. Like, I actually felt like Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson were having a phenomenal time.
Colin Farrell was singing the hell out of Happy Birthday, man.
Yeah, they were there. I mean, there's got to be like he was having fun
when not that Colin Farrell probably, but like Brendan Gleeson probably knew he wasn't going to win. So I feel like there'd be joy in that. Like, if you know that you're the guy in your category that's not going to win, just treat it like you're going to a great party. Like, maybe get a little drunk on the red carpet, enjoy it. Yeah, like, just kick back and just cheer other people on and just have a great
win.
Yeah, but and you go, oh my god, and then you're Adrian Brody.
Yeah, you took an edible. You're like, you had a couple beers, and then like they call your. What's funny about Sean? I don't want to cut you off, but real quick, in terms of the actress category, when Michelle Yeoh's name got called, think about Michelle Williams for a second, right?
Had to have been prepared for that, though.
I know that, but my point is, like, you're going to hear your first name, and you got to. She had to, like, think about the art form of her face. She probably had to wait a beat. Right. Yeah. Because, I mean, she probably knew that it was Michelle Yeoh or Kate Blanchett. But again, when you hear your first name, she probably had to practice the idea of, OK, wait for the second name to come out. Yeah. I would imagine. But yeah. What were you going to say, Sean? Sorry.
I felt bad for Judd Hirsch. You know, how many more opportunities Judd Hirsch going to get? It was really funny after that scene happened. That, you know, the quick reaction out of Toronto was just like, oh, my God, that's the scene. Kind of thing, and then it just didn't come together for him.
If I'm a director, I say from here on out. If I'm a director, I say don't put my movie in Toronto. Like, it feels like all the movies that peak in Toronto cannot keep.
But you can't say that Everything Everywhere All at Once opened at South by.
Yeah, but I think the thing is, I think it's better because with Toronto, the Oscar race starts and you have to keep up that momentum. With Everything Everywhere All at Once, it was able to come out, it was able to enjoy some acclaim, and then it was able to almost rest and recharge for a little bit, and then reemerge right at the right point. Out of Toronto, you almost have to just keep the wheels turning for like 6, 7, 8 months to stay in the conversation. I'd say it's better to come out in March or April and then die down for a little bit and then come back. Because remember, Coda came out in like, what, late July, August, beginning of August? And so even Coda was able to die down for a little bit.
Didn't the Coda buzz start at Sundance, though? Like, that kind of started in
Was it? Yeah, but then I feel like most people weren't even talking about Coda. Like, honestly, I gotta be honest, like, I didn't really, until we did the junket, really watch Coda. And that was late July.
I think it's a fair point about Toronto. I think it's a fair observation. But how do you argue Venice, which is like, what, like a week before or so? And the Whale was there.
I mean, but how many? Yeah, but the, I mean, outside of Brendan, the Whale did. I mean, the Whale was not the contender it was going to be. Like there were people. I mean, it didn't get picture, didn't get screenplay, didn't get director. It was not the powerhouse. But whenever I think of the movies that came out of Toronto that were supposed to be it, and I'm thinking The Fabelmans, I'm thinking A Star Is Born, I'm thinking Power of the Dog. Was Power of the Dog in Toronto?
I think it won. Didn't Power of the Dog win?
So I'm just thinking of these movies that just, it's impossible to keep. I mean, especially with them pushing back the Oscars to March, you can't keep the wheels turning at that pace from September all the way, because there's no time to rest. You don't have time to rest if you're coming out of Toronto.
Also, you know, that's, in my opinion, the reason Angela Bassett didn't win the Oscar is because it happened in March. I really believe that. I think it's a momentum thing, because I really do believe that momentum can shift so extreme, especially with the voting happening so late, that, like, you know, you'll see this happen a lot. She had an incredible momentum. Bassett did.
But see, I don't think she had the support from that community that we think that she did.
I disagree. Really? I think she was the front runner. I'm not saying the Globes are connected to the Oscars in any way, but I do believe there was a time period for at least a month or so where she was the front runner to win. And I think as time passed, and then with Jamie winning that SAG award, things completely changed and shifted away from Bassett. We all even said this. We even said, like, that she was the frontrunner for a long time. And then
do you think there's still a Marvel stigma?
No, I don't think it's a stigma. I really don't. I don't think it has anything to do with Marvel. In that case, I think that she lost because it happened in March. If this show happened in January, she would have won, in my opinion.
Interesting. All right. Well, speaking of would have won, Gabriel, you have the results of our Oscar wager win.
I do.
I feel like
all of our Zoom squares are now like the Oscar squares that are up for, like, when they're about to announce the winner.
And then here are our nominees. This is a fun year, really tight year, a really, really tight competition this year. And I'll start with saying that we have a tie.
Oh,
wow.
For a second.
But I'll finish by saying we have a tie for last place.
So Jake won, Sean and I tied.
It's very close. Winning with 14 points to the other two's 13 points.
Oh, wow.
Very close. Is the champion himself, Jake Hamilton. Man, 14 categories won.
Gross.
Well Damn done. Right. Well
do
done.
Do you know what the category that pushed him over is?
Let me see.
What did Kevin actually missed?
Kevin had quite a few outliers with getting production design correct, getting Fraser correct.
Jake and I went Austin Butler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was Maverick for sound that really put him over. Was the one category over the two? Okay.
The one that screwed me was documentary. I should have gone to Volney. And then I would have tied.
Yeah, you had some good ones. Like I said, you picked up Fraser, you picked up All Quiet for production design.
Did we all say Hurwitz for score?
I think we did.
Yeah.
None of us thought All Quiet was going to dominate the way it did. I thought it would be much more spread out.
Did really well.
It had the Mad Max effect.
Jake and Sean also picked Babylon for production design, but that's the All Quiet win that that Kev got. So,
interesting. Well done.
Yeah.
All right.
Fraser was that was my spicy pick, because I felt like there was a momentum for Butler.
I will say, the moment the Whale won makeup, I knew in that moment, okay, Fraser's, because I always thought that makeup and actor were going to go hand in hand, which is why I picked Elvis for makeup. The moment that the Whale won makeup, I thought, well, there goes actor.
Jake, do you have our punishment handy, or do you need a week to think about it?
You know what? I'm going to take the next 7 days and just enjoy the moment. Because you know, like, after someone wins an Oscar, the next day they do the talk shows and they do the photo shoots in their robe with the Oscar and sitting by their poolside. So I'm going to do all those things. I'm going to take my photo shoots. I'm going to do my interviews. And then I'll come back to you guys in a week and let you know which unspeakable project I want to put in front of your eyeballs.
That reminds me, Jake, Variety is going to be meeting you out in your apartment about
Well, they know my address because they've been here before.
Oh. Damn right.
All right. This week in movies, we have one major film that we want to get to and is the latest from DC Films. It is Shazam Fury of the Gods. I'm going to go first because I want to talk about Shazam Fury of the Gods. I really like this movie. I thought it was a lot of fun. I'll go fast. I'll go relatively quick through it. I think that most people are going to check this out because they're curious. I want to say right off the bat, I know there was a lot of fear of like this movie doesn't matter because the DCEU is about to get rebooted or soft rebooted. But I still think without giving any kind of spoilers away that it is both entertaining and it's very easy to see how this film can still be considered part of the larger fabric of what James Gunn is trying to do. I liked, this is weird. The one person who I didn't really like that much in the movie is Zachary Levi. I think that he's weirdly miscast.
Is it Levi?
It could be Levi. All right, okay. Zachary Levi. I'm kind of tired of his Shazam shtick, but I find everybody else really entertaining.
It's like, two movies in. How can you be tired of his Shazam shtick?
I just am like I'm more entertained by the people around him. Like Jack Dylan Grazer has a really great subplot with Jaiman Hansu that I found to be really, really funny. I like the rest of the Shazam family and the different character arcs that they get to develop. I really like the Daughters of Atlas. I thought that they were interesting characters. And there are multiple scenes where like you get a scene where Helen Mirren and Lucy Liu and Jaiman Hansu are legitimately diving into this, you know, conversation about mythology. And I'm like, I'm super on board with this. These are great actors who are treating this almost like Shakespeare. And so I was in. David Sandberg gets to do a little bit with creature design towards the end. I wish he got to do a little bit more of that. That's definitely where his interests lie. He's got a horror background. I liked how this movie leaned heavier into the magic element of Shazam. We explore the lair a lot more and play around with that realm of doors, but also get to meet a new library area. That's kind of fascinating. And it's very clear that the Shazam universe is different from what else you're getting in DC. And I thought the first movie was a little bit limited by its budget. And I think that they put more money into this. I thought the special effects looked really, really good. There's a dome element that gets put over Philadelphia. There's moments where this tree that gets planted, the roots are taking over the city. And again, all the creatures that sort of happen. Is it great? No, but I thought it took everything that worked in the first Shazam and kind of expanded on it. And so if you told me that this team was going to stick together and continue to make a couple more Shazam movies, I would be very happy. Kev, I think you disagree with me, so I would love to hear where you fall on it.
Yeah, I mean, so I saw a film the other day that was very CGI heavy that I loved so much, and I won't go into the details of it now because we'll talk about it when it comes out. So I want to use that as a jumping off point, because when I talk about CGI, there are films that do it well, that have good writing and good script and good characters, and it's designed well. Here, you know, I just felt like the CGI at times felt, it just took me out of the movie. Now, don't get me wrong, I have love for CGI artists. I think CGI is a great tool for filmmakers, but there are times where it feels like it can break the immersion for me. And I think that's the art of a great director, is somebody like, I remember Nolan talked about how Denis Villeneuve like really blended CGI and practical really well in Dune. And, you know, Nolan's a big practical effects guy, and for him to complement Dune, which has CGI, it's still very heavy location shooting. That to me is an art form to nail that. That being said, I also agree with you. I think Zachary Levi was great in the first one. I love the first Shazam. I thought it was incredibly fun. So much fun. I also love the thematics, the serious nature surrounding the child and the foster care aspect of the storyline and the character of Asher Angel's character, aging out of the foster care system. That whole arc in this one is really interesting.
The family gets good elements. The family gets a really good storyline, which I was happy about.
To me, that's the best part of the film, is the family aspect of it. I also think Jack Dylan Grazer is great in these. He's my favorite person in these films. I thought Rachel Zegler and Helen Mirren and Lucy Liu were great in the film as well. I didn't particularly care for the storyline, the villain storyline. It just didn't capture me. This one felt like it didn't have a certain direction to it. The first one just felt fresh and funny and unique and interesting, like a PG-13 Deadpool. But then this was kind of more, it felt like they were making a sequel because they had to make a sequel rather than it didn't feel as inspired as the original. And I think, you know, listen, at the end of the day, I think Sandberg's a really great director. I think I actually very excited to see what he does next. This just felt limited to me. Even the ending, I just wasn't really big into the way it was done. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was fine. But this is coming from somebody who loved the first Shazam, a big DC Comics fan in terms of the movies. Always have been. I'm very excited to see what James Gunn does continuing on. But yeah, I thought it was fine. It just, to me, it was disappointing in terms of the first one. I'd watch the first one a million times over than this one again. I mean, I'll see it again eventually, but you know, it was fine.
Before I throw it to Jake, Gabe, do we have a DC tier list?
We do. I was just actually looking at that right now to see where we could. I'll have that ready for at the end of this.
Beautiful. Jakey, yeah. Where do you fall, between us or what's the deal?
I lean a little closer to it's fine. Okay. You know, I too love the first one, but the thing that I loved most about the first one was the smallness of it. The intimacy of more so the boy than the superhero that he turns into. It leaned more on the boy and this orphan. Daenerys agrees. It leaned more
huge fan
of the smallness. So I felt like you know, the elevator pitch we were all using when the first one came out was like, what if Big met Superman? And I felt that the reason that I liked the first one as much as I did is that, one, it had that Amblin 80s dark edge to it that our kids' movies used to have back in the day. Right. But it also had, like, I enjoyed the smallness of, like, the big side of things. And this sequel leans more toward the Superman spectacle of it. And I miss sort of, like, those smaller moments. Kevin, you're absolutely right. Whenever it's about, you know, Billy and potentially aging out of, like, those small details, like, I'm like, oh, give me more of that. But I felt like that those moments, even them in high school, were lessened in exchange for these big, massive, epic CGI filled sequences that quite frankly didn't feel different enough. I mean, the first one felt really like a thing that that was unique and stood on its own compared to not just the DC films we were seeing at the time, but all of the superhero movies that were coming out around that era. And this one kind of just feels like it's trying to fit in with everything else that's coming out and just is kind of at the back of the pack. There are a lot of moments about it that I enjoyed. There were some laughed out loud moments in the script. I do think all the kids have such great chemistry together, but it felt like this movie really caved and just fell victim to all the things that I'm glad it had avoided the first time around.
Better or worse than Black Adam?
Better.
Better, but also better than Quantumania.
That's a different tier list. I'm picturing if we did both universes on one list, just
yeah, the reasons.
God. All right, interesting. So
do we want to pull up the tier list? Do we want to look
at
it?
Let's do it. Yeah, let's give it a shot.
All right. Here is our DC right now. It says DCEU tier list at the bottom there. But I guess DCU tier list, who knows?
To me, C fits it perfectly and kind of fits in with those movies that are there right now.
Interesting. I have not seen this movie yet, so it's on the three of you.
I'm a B, but I'm outnumbered. Yeah. I'm a B and I'm a pretty strong B because I don't think the first one is better per se.
I like this tier list. I'm sometimes you pull back up the tier list and I've forgotten about them and I see them and it makes me angry all over again, like the Marvel one. But this one I'm fairly happy with.
It's pretty good. I think DC's a lot easier to manage.
Sure.
Wonder Woman 84 should not be a B. That's we made a mistake there.
That's a C.
That's a C.
You're a C.
I could see it going either way. I think that I probably argued for it to go B because I think I enjoyed a lot of it more than people did.
I definitely liked 84 more than most people.
Yeah.
I like Fury of the Gods more than 84.
84 was a weird one.
Do that, Sean. It's not how it works.
I know. I understand that.
84 was a weird one. Not to talk about a different movie, but 84 was a weird one because we saw that. We were like, that was really enjoyable. And then the world saw it and it was like, oh my gosh,
It was also such a weird time because it was like one of the first big blockbusters to come out during the pandemic. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I saw it here at home.
Yeah, yeah.
For the junket. Max, so yeah. Like it was the
theater.
Did you? Did they screen it for you in the theater?
That's nice.
Yeah. They didn't screen it for
well,
me.
Well, no, I mean, they gave me an option and I wanted to go to the theater.
That's a better choice.
I'm going to email my Warner Brothers rep like, bitching about something that happened 2 years ago.
Yeah, that'll help your case. So it sounds like we're a C. It sounds like we're a C. If, yeah. When I finally get to see it, if it's an A for me, I'll force us to bring this back up and rehash this. But
sorry,
we're going to put it,
that's not how it works.
Put it at C.
It's in, baby. Chisel it in stone.
At C.
All right. So I'll be really curious to see how this does at the box office. The preliminary predictions heading into the weekend was 24 million. We're recording this on
it's pretty low.
This on Wednesday.
But what else can you expect whenever you kind of blow up your universe and they don't really tell anyone if it's worth seeing this? And so like whether we agree with it or not from like how you should enjoy movies, these movies are built on continued stories. Mm-hmm. And if you're telling people like, it might not matter, like,
yeah.
Well, and also, like, with each passing weekend now, the competition gets a little bit harder because mm-hmm. Creed 3 is still there, and Scream 6 is now still there, and now Shazam has to cut through all of those.
4465 is waving his flag going, hey, we're good, too.
To that end, though, I do want to ask you guys, because, as I said, I have not seen this yet. No spoilers. But when you left the movie, did you feel like, oh, we should continue on, or is it still a gray area? Or okay,
I don't know how much I can say, but like apparently there are two post-credit scenes that when Kevin and I were at the junket, we were not shown.
Oh, okay,
we were told details of one of them.
Okay,
which intrigues me. If there is truth behind it, really intrigues me. Sean, have you heard anything at this point as to what the post-credit scenes are and the implication that they have on the future?
Yes, but I heard two conflicting things. Heard one which is very significant, and then I heard one that's like a watered down version of
question. Is this an interesting enough point that we can put us behind a spoiler wall for 4 minutes real quick if you want to discuss them openly?
I'd just like to know what you heard. So Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong. Real quick.
Listeners at home. Full spoilers for a few minutes. If you want to skip spoilers, look at when the next segment starts. We'll move on after this bit. But go ahead.
Yeah, and we'll know this isn't a huge deal because by the time it comes out. But we had heard that one of the post-credit scenes involved Shazam meeting the Justice League. Now, what that means exactly, or how it's filmed, I mean, it's particularly with the Shazam films because they love like having the characters but not the actors and kind of shooting that middle tier version of them. But I don't know what that means or if there's truth to it or how the scene plays out. But we just heard that there was a scene. And again, whenever they showed it to us at the press junket, they cut the scenes out and it was not a part of it. So, Sean, what have you heard?
I heard that he gets approached by Jennifer Hardcore and the dude from Peacemaker, like James Gunn's wife. And the dude from Peacemaker.
Interesting.
And they're recruiting him for the JSA, which was featured in Black Adam. So not the Justice League, but the JSA.
Maybe. Okay. Interesting.
And so you won't see him get approached by full on Justice League members. You'll see him get approached by two Suicide Squad Peacemaker characters. And they'll say, hey, come join the JSA.
I mean, but they're having him join a team from a movie that they've already said is not continuing.
Well, I could see them very easily continuing the JSA and maybe bringing in some more interesting characters. I mean, they lost Dr. Fate. You know, you could still have Hawkman. I don't think Hawkman was a problem.
Yeah.
You just bring in Shazam and a couple other.
Do you think this is the last time we see Zachary Levi play Shazam?
No, I don't think so. I think they keep him.
Okay.
And I had a conversation with Hannah in the DC videos that we do. I also don't think that Gal Gadot is finished as Wonder Woman. I think that she is still very much
great Wonder Woman. Like it would be tough part. To lose her. Yeah.
It was cool. I love the setup of the joke that like we don't see her at the beginning. And so you think from here on out, anytime anyone from the DCEU is going to be in the Shazam films, they're going to be filmed in that way. Yeah, and then the payoff is, wait, we actually got her.
Yeah.
This is very not much related, but sort of related. And I'll ask Sean this before we have to go. James Gunn announced that he's directing Superman. My simple question is, do you think he casts a known actor or do you think he well-known, I should say, maybe A-list is too high. Maybe, you know, not necessarily megastar actor, Superman or an unknown. Do we get like a new talent?
My guess is unknown.
Yeah. I always think that's better.
Mm-hmm. For, my guess is going to be
for something as iconic as Superman. Because you're like, yeah. Hey, it's Nick Cage. Like, it's not what you want.
Right. It would be really, really, really funny if you brought Nick Cage back on. Because of the entire, that Tim Burton movie and that footage and those pictures of him.
Yeah.
If they were to somehow figure that out, like a Shazam thing where like a younger Superman becomes older Nick Cage, it would be hilarious.
Like, I don't watch enough of Superman and Lois, the show that's on HBO Max, but that kid that they cast in that.
From Road to Perdition.
Perfect. Oh, is he the son?
Yeah, he's the son from Road to Perdition.
Get out of here. Yeah. Is his name Tyler Hoechlin?
Yeah.
Or something? Okay. He just looks like Superman. He looks like he's a great.
I've actually
Superman.
Heard that show was fantastic.
I've heard that as well, too. I need to watch more of it. But like, I think if James finds somebody who looks like that, you know, who just it has the look, then you go with that. And you,
okay, before we go to break, I want to present a hypothetical. Sean, you wake up one morning.
Yeah.
You pull out your phone, a billion text messages like I had yesterday whenever I got out of Dungeons and Dragons and the Tarantino news had been released.
Oh, yeah.
And you
yeah.
see, you, and you think to yourself, oh my God, news has dropped or something happened. And you check the headline, Kevin McCarthy cast by James Gunn as Superman.
Which
damn
one?
Right.
Which one?
Which Kevin?
And then, because we know Kevin has been at the gym a lot. Kevin's been getting jacked. Kevin's looking good.
He might be under NDA.
It turns out that's why he's been doing it. Yeah. He's training for Superman.
Kevin is Affleck. Kevin's Batman without a doubt. Yeah. He's pulling the chain and the tire. He's out there.
Kevin, if we find out that you've been cast as Superman for like months now, how long are we allowed to be mad at you before we're proud of you? Like, for not telling us. Like, how long can we be mad at you?
Oh, you guys would know right away. You guys would know initially.
That's amazing. All right, let's take a quick break and come back on the other side and play our blind game.
But a note, before we go, we're losing Jake. We won't see Jake on the other side.
Bye, Jacob.
Has to go.
Bye, Jake.
Love you guys. Love you guys.
Love you too. All right, let's close out this episode with a blend game. And on behalf of Shazam, Fury of the Gods, we are going with one of the daughters of Atlas, the great Helen Mirren, who has been in countless films over the years and won an Oscar for playing the Queen. So you can go with any of those as a choice. I'll start with Kevin. Kevin, where did you end up going for your favorite Helen Mirren?
I mean, I actually really like her in the Fast and Furious films in terms of like my favorite aspect of things. But I mean, the Queen is the one I have to go with because it's the one I associate with her in terms of like just the her disappearing in that role. It was a brilliant performance. And, you know, I know it was a while ago, but I still think of that role when I see her just because of the transformation and what she did with it. And it was iconic. And I just remember it was also just one of those performances that was just legendary. It just I remember being so blown away by seeing it. I was very happy with the way she, you know, portrayed the character in terms of like bringing it to the screen. And I think Stephen Frears directed that movie, I want to say.
Stephen Frears. And it was a movie about the time, like right after Diana's death, when you really had to wonder how the royal family was going to respond to that.
Right.
So I thought it gave her a ton of great material to chew on.
Yeah, no, that's honestly my pick. I thought she was fantastic in that. I mean, listen, I love watching her show up in the Fast and Furious movies. That's when I see Helen Mirren and Vin Diesel driving together. It's awesome. Like if I'm going to be honest with you, that's probably my favorite thing she's done. But the problem with choosing that is I'm disregarding all of her brilliant dramatic work and things like that. But I liked seeing her step out of the box and have fun. I loved her in Hitchcock as well. But I think the Queen's my favorite, the best thing she's done. But I do love her in the Fast and Furious franchise.
You know, I think the Red movies opened her up to Fast and Furious.
Yeah.
I think seeing her in those movies proved to the Fast and Furious producers like, oh, we can put her in this and she'll have a lot of fun.
Right.
So, I went back a little bit further and I chose a Helen Mirren movie that I've always enjoyed. It came during a period when a couple of these movies were made, Waking Ned Divine and films like that, that are just inspirational older folk movies, and it's called Calendar Girls, and it's about these women in a small British town who do a fundraiser every single year, and it's gone stale. You know, they essentially keep repeating the same ideas, and they have the idea of a calendar, but they're gonna shoot fruit, and it's just they know it's gonna be a failure. But when one of the ladies, played by Julie Walters, who is also terrific, Her husband becomes sick with cancer. They realize the fundraiser is going to go to him. And so in order to make it succeed, they're going to shoot a calendar where all the older women pose nude. And it's just really funny. Like, it's extremely sweet and it's extremely charming. And Helen Mirren, I'm not quite sure. I think people knew who she was, but I don't know if they recognize that she could really carry a lead performance. And her and Julie Walters in it together are fantastic. If you haven't had a chance to see Calendar Girls, it's a great example that Helen Mirren can operate outside of a period picture, because I think it's very easy to sort of put her into The Madness of King George or The Queen, as Kevin mentioned. But when you allow her to sort of flex her comedic muscles, she can do a really, really great job. And if you haven't seen Calendar Girls before, give that a shot. So Jake did record a pick for us. Let's throw to his pick right now.
Hey guys, sorry I had to bail on the show early, but I did not want to miss out on the chance to pick my favorite Helen Mirren performance. And I gotta be honest, I actually normally hate picking someone like one of the most acclaimed roles or maybe the role they won the Oscar for. So I spent a good period of time trying to find something other than when she played Queen Elizabeth. But I just couldn't pick anything beyond that, just because what she does with that role, giving new depth and dimension to someone who most of us grow up knowing, to someone who we feel like we've known our entire lives. I feel like she sort of made me feel like I really did actually get to know this person, someone who has to famously keep so much of how she's feeling internal. And what Helen has to do is take one of the most recognizable people of all time and make us see her in a different light, but has to do so by not really giving us that much, because so much of what she's dealing with after the death of Diana and how she famous or maybe infamously dealt with speaking out about that death, it's all inside. But it's there and you can see it. And I just feel like she was given so few tools to work with, aside from obviously an incredible script, but nothing but just her skills as an actor. And it wouldn't have worked really if anyone else had played that part. So I really did try to find something else, another part, but that's the one I'm going with. So thanks, guys.
And in addition to Jake's pick, we have some audience picks as well, too. Damian McDonald says her role in the TV series Prime Suspect, which I do not know about, but I will have to look that up. Matt Caron said Hobbs and Shaw. And Gavin Gouge from Tennessee says, since it's favorite and not best, he went with National Treasure, Book of Secrets, which I forgot that she was even in this. A little bit more Nick Cage talk as well, too. So much participation this week. Thank you guys, everybody, for participating. For next week, reach out on Twitter using hashtag action set piece blend.
Interesting.
Yes. And some of them might come from the movie that we're going to speak about next week.
Damn right.
Because... holy hell.
Wait till y'all see John Wick 4.
It's a series of your mind. Blend game worthy action set pieces.
Yeah.
Wow. Oof. All right. We're going to get into greater detail about that. So again, hashtag action set piece blend. Use it on Twitter or email us your pick at realblend@cinemablend.com. Our next premium episode is going to drop on Monday. If you want to be part of the premium episodes, go to the description where you're listening right now. Find out how to subscribe to it. It's $5 a month. As mentioned, to get you a bonus episode on Mondays, a newsletter, and an ad-free version of the show. While you're waiting for new content to drop, follow us on social media. We are at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show is at Real Blend. Oh, shoot. Right. Got it. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then, Hubie.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.